to the Find a Way podcast,
where we celebrate the remarkable journeys of immigrant entrepreneurs who have founded startups in North America.
And we are your hosts, Beatrice Zanatelli
and Ingrid Polini.
Join us as we dive deep into the personal stories of these inspiring individuals, exploring their challenges, triumphs, and the diverse range of innovative companies they have built.
This is episode number 72, Mastering Tech. Today, our guest is Gilson Tori. Gilson is a tech operator with extensive experience as a founder and executive. He is also a startup advisor, mentor, and angel investor. With a 20-plus year career in technology companies, Gilson built and led teams in multiple functional areas. He has been a COO, CMO, CPO, business unit leader, and co-founder, leading teams of hundreds of people in seven countries. Born and raised in Brazil, he has lived in the U.S. twice and migrated to Canada in 2018. Welcome, Gilson.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm super happy to be here.
So before we start, can you tell us about, I know you have multiple businesses, but about your latest business and what it does? Like, this is your time to shine light on your new project.
Yeah, no, actually, to be very fair and honest, I am transitioning and I'm looking for a new project to be, let's say, more full-time as an operator. And while I'm doing that, I'm trying to help some founders that I know and I've met along the way. As a fractional COO, potentially a startup advisor if it's too early for them to have someone in operations. And this is what I'm doing. I've always tried to help people and founders that I met along the way. Now in the last couple of months, that's what I'm doing a little more full time, a little more seriously.
Thank you, Gilson. When we read a little bit about your founder journey and your executive journey as well. So one of the things that I wanted to understand more was some key insights or lessons that you've learned during your time specifically at NeoGrid in the journey from a seed stage company to a pre-IPO level.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many, right? I've been there for literally about 13 years. When we started, we were literally seven people. It actually started in a company called X-Plan out of college where, me and a couple of people that studied in the same college, we banded together. We started thinking about supply chain. And this was a part of the technology evolution where SaaS was becoming a thing. And we found an opportunity, right, to combat just SAP and Oracles and huge companies that were trying to get into the Brazilian market, but we're still not there yet. The projects were multi-million dollar implementations and a Brazilian alternative sounded like a great thing, even for companies that were trying to implement those concepts in a worldwide scale. So that's what we tried to implement in the following years. That company got acquired by NeoGrid. And that became the platform to what was a huge, let's say, endeavor into building a company that got to a top 20 Gartner solution in the field, has become very relevant in many markets around the world. We were 700 people and having revenue that was at an IPO level for multiple parameters, right? So, of course, we've learned in a journey like that, you learn that startups become scale-ups and scale-ups become growth companies and you've learned so many things along the way. You meet a lot of different people. You have to rebuild a lot of things, but all in all, a very interesting adventure, very interesting learnings and a lot of fun, of course.
Just to add a little point before Ingrid jumps in, just for our listeners, NeoGrid is a supply chain management SaaS company and some fun facts here is that in 13 years, the company grew 25 times in revenue and also from seven employee to 700 people. So it's a huge deal.
Yeah.
And on to that, like, I would love to understand. So I would change the question that Bia asked a little bit. Like, if you had a COO that you were mentoring right now, right? And they're going from that transition, let's say they are on like the 50 like people that they're managing to like going to like the 200 or like really like the scale up pain. what would be the two or three main points that you say you need to watch this or like this? So like if we have COOs that are going through those growing pains right now, what would be the main like pain points that you'd say you have to watch for this or you have to prepare for that?
Yeah, I mean, look, the truth is COOs, they have, it's really hard to understand what a COO does from the outside. Because the reality is we fill a lot of different roles that are not being filled by the company at that particular moment in time, right? So if you are in a super early stage startup, you look into the founder and the founding team, you look what are the gaps that you need to fulfill, and that's probably what the COO is going to do in the first place, right? As the company evolves, and as you said, on a 50-people company, you have different needs or you have different things that you're trying to accomplish to reach that next growth stage. Some of them are related to operational efficiency. You know, things that were working, they are just not working as efficient right now. And that's where your focus goes. Sometimes it's about growth plans, right? We are trying to get into a new market. We are trying to get into a new position or you're trying to develop a new line of product. And this is such a strategic initiative that you have to synchronize and cross-align different teams that are working on that. So that becomes more the COO role. To me, again, it's more about trying to anticipate what needs to be done in order for you not to stop or for you to be more effective or for you to reach that next level. So it's all about identifying the trends and you see in the operation the day-to-day what's working, what's not quite there. The things that were working but stopped working and then trying to get the team together to figure out what's the next step, right? It's all about that understanding of what's going on plus where you're trying to achieve and what's going to stop you from getting there, right? And then trying to make the plans to actually make that thing work. It's a version of that. The theory is fairly easy to understand. The practice is a lot messier than it sounds, right? Because, of course, you are dealing with different types of people. You're dealing with people that have different levels of understanding. You have different strategies that are coming your way. Things happen that you don't control. And of course, you have to react to those. So it's a mixed bag of a lot of different subjects at the same time.
That's awesome. Thank you. I think that would be very helpful for people like just getting in or like just fitting into the COO role, especially as founders. I would love to hear more specifically about your experience, like from your experience in NeoGrid, how does it inform or influence your approach to building companies from scratch? So like you went from like, you know, building and supporting this company, build like all these like large teams, and then you go back to the micro level and like, you know, start from the scratch, especially in the sustainability or like the HR tech,
yeah.
Sectors. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, of course, as I was thinking in the beginning, right, you've learned so much. And I think the biggest challenge is for you not to start running before you're walking, right? What NeoGrid has done, of course, it's a little out of the ordinary where you keep growing at a pace. And our strategy was led by acquisitions plus organic growth. So that created a lot of complexity along the way. And today, when I look into companies that are in an earlier stage, you have to avoid that temptation of trying to do things in a perfect, in the most, let's say, classical way before you're ready for that, right? Otherwise, you start creating a lot of bureaucracy. Otherwise, you start creating a lot of processes ahead of time. And that, of course, stalls energy, stalls creativity, stalls speed, right? Which is so important in earlier stage companies. So you have to balance that out. I think that whole experience gave me a notion of what's possible, what are the many things that may come in your way. But of course, it also has to give me the idea of don't do things too fast because this is gonna make you suffer in the short term. And of course, you want to balance that thing out.
And it's basically what you just said is leading to our question as well.
You've been deeply involved in both product development and business operations. So first question is, which one is your favorite? So I can move into my next kind of question.
Really tough question. I like both, honestly. But I think what I think both have in common is this notion of connecting the dots on multiple different things, right? For you to be a good product operator, you have to be able to connect the strategy to the operations, to also what's going on in the market, to what is your team actually able to deliver in the short term versus what is the vision that you're accomplishing long term. For operations, it's the same thing, but now you're trying to connect the dots of the multiple functional areas or the functional needs with the long-term strategy of the company. So both of them have different layers, and I like doing both. I tend to enjoy and stay more in the operation level of companies, because in the end of the day, I feel like if you look into my resume, I'm not the classical CPO that has been a product manager, product director, VP, and group product, and raised to the CPO level. I'm not a specialist in that particular sense. I'm more of a generalist that can go from zero to one and help us build the teams that are specialized at the right time, right? So to me, that's kind of my more of my game. It's understanding what is the gap, trying to build the structure and find the right team to execute it when the time is right.
And besides connecting the dots, as you mentioned, because is there any specific strategy that you would probably advise other people on the same journey in balancing these two aspects in a startup environment? Like when you're still limited with resources, how do you, you know, do that balancing of those two big pillars?
If there's any, you know, sometimes you have a choice, sometimes you don't in startups, right? I think sometimes it's very obvious in the sense that here's what the company needs to do right now, otherwise it won't survive tomorrow. And I think sometimes we forget about that as startup operators. We start thinking about what's going to happen in the next 2 years and trying to find that scalable thing. But the truth is we need to actually concentrate on the now and making sure we have a tomorrow, right? So to me, it's more this notion of look what's going on right now and do what needs to be done right now. And then try to think about how you're spending your time, how you're spending your day, what are the actions that you're putting in place so that you have tomorrow. And of course, don't lose sight of what comes next and tomorrow, but remember that if you don't do what needs to be done right now, you may not even have that chance, right? So that's the balance that I think I'm always battling in early stage startup, and I'm always battling with the founders. So that they are focused on what needs to be done now.
On that note, but more specific to your experience with Nugget AI, can you tell us what inspired the transition to Nugget AI, and what were some of the unique contributions did you bring to the founding team of System 3? And like in terms of product development and strategic directions, like what were some of the things that made you transition, and like what were some of the contributions that you're like, oh, I'm really proud that I did this, right?
There's a lot there, but let's start from the transition. I think it was a natural transition time in my life, right? I was living NeoGrid after several years. It was super fun, again, super grateful for all the journey. But that coincidentally was a transition for me moving to Canada, right? And when I moved to Canada, it was purposefully done in a way that we were prioritizing, me and my family were prioritizing having a different lifestyle. We wanted to live overseas, and that was the opportunity that we decided to explore. When you do those life changes, I think it provokes in you a little bit of a niche to rethink life, honestly. And, you know, when you start thinking about it and get a lot of advice from experienced people and people that I like, they always said, okay, think about the times that you had most fun, right? And what were those like in the last couple of years? And it was always related to this notion of creating something, right? Resolving a problem that existed and that we saw. and trying to figure out what is the pathway for us to solve it. That, of course, resembles a lot startups, resembles a lot what founders do. So I thought I would give it a shot, right? So that's kind of the long answer to why transition in the first place to an early stage. I think it was the perfect timing in my life. It was a good, let's say, mindset that I had at the time, and a good bat for me to think about starting something from scratch at that time in my life. Now, what drew me to HR Tech and specifically to Nugget AI was a bit of serendipity. It was literally starting to talk to a lot of entrepreneurs. I didn't know anybody when I moved here to Canada. And, you know, people started introducing me to other people, and I started hanging out where founders were. So all the events, the Elevates, the Mars networks and Tech.io and all the events that I could think of, I was just there mingling and trying to understand how the ecosystem worked. And one of these were events. My co-founder of Nugget AI reached out to me and said, look, we are interested in potential angel investing, but also we're interested in people that have built tech products successfully in the past. Would you care to have a coffee and chat? And I've learned that this happened a lot here, which I loved, in the ecosystem that we have here in Canada. And I was having multiple of those conversations every day. I really liked the problem that they were trying to solve. As a manager, I suffered a lot about this notion of hiring and not exactly knowing why it didn't work or why it worked. You spend a lot of energy and you spend a lot of resources trying to figure out that matching. And the notion of having objective data to help me take that decision, never to take that decision for me, but to inform me better why that decision worked out, what is the type of combination of skills, personality that work, was very intriguing to me. And of course, this is a huge problem to solve, and we could spend, you know, years and years building interesting businesses around that only particular topic, right? So that's what made me fall in love with the idea of Nugget AI. We were essentially trying to combine industry organizational psychology, which is how minds and people think about solving problems and how people think about work in general, and creating objective data to help people take decisions on people, right? This has always been an interesting idea that were spearheaded by assessments in general, but the way that assessment industry works needed some revamp, right? So all of us have done some version of assessment in part of our career. And we felt that there was a better way to do it. So we created an artificial intelligence model that was, at the time, a small language model. Now everybody knows large language models. But at the time, we were trying to replicate the idea of creating a small language model that could detect soft skills and understand the person a little bit better, how this person thinks, how this person acts, and what is the likelihood that this would be a good fit into your culture, into your organization, and into the role that you are offering this person, right? So that was the basis of what we were trying to do with Nugget. It was super fun. And again, what I brought to the table was an expertise to build products and to essentially try to make them in a way that we could sell to large enterprises. This was complemented by the co-founding team that had technical expertise and also industry organizational psychology expertise, right? So that was kind of the three-legged stool that we needed for us to go to market and create something from scratch. I'm saying a lot of things, but just to end it, the system three, very different, right? Because after a couple of years that I've done this, explored into this market, Nugget AI was sold after the pandemic in a very, let's say, situational moments there. And you know, after a year, after we sold the company, I was ready for me to start building or creating something different. But it turns out the world works in funny ways, so that along this journey, I met someone that was super interested in the same idea, but with a very, very high degree of focus and a very deep expertise into how this market worked in the executive level, right? So I thought it was an interesting continuation of what we've tried to do before, which was more focused on high volume hiring. And then this would be a very niche, super premium market that was focused on the executive level, right? We, of course, had to create a very different experience than what we created for a high volume recruiting. But it's conceptually a similar idea of trying to bring objective data to mitigate bias, take better decisions, and potentially inform better decisions in high-level executive talent. In this case, the founder had more years than not in the executive search level experience, both in recruiting and development. And what I brought to the table was more the product and the technical side of it, right? So how do we create a technology company out of this particular expertise? And of course, matching a more go-to-market person versus in executive experience with someone that has the expertise of creating products and technology. So that was kind of the long explanation of why you asked, Ingrid. I hope I did a little bit of justice there.
This was amazing. And I am definitely going to be booking our coffee afterwards in Toronto so I can pick your brain on some things that I have in my brain. So that would be a great match.
That's awesome. Looking forward to it.
No, for sure. We'll get that in the calendars. Gilson, with your background in mechanical engineer and also having an executive MBA, how have these disciplines influenced your leadership style and your approach to innovation within the tech industry?
It's a very good question. I think like an engineer, and I think that's what the mechanical engineer background gave me. The first thing that comes to my mind, whatever topic you give me, is what led us here, what's going on, and what will happen next. That's exactly what engineers are trained to think. You know, if you think about a car or you think about a machine, we are trained to understand how the machine works, but also why is it that this machine exists, right? What is the problem that this machine solves? And what is the repercussion of this machine? What is the productivity? What is the output? And so on. If you think about that mechanic of how mechanical engineers work, this is exactly how my brain is wired. And I think that shaped a lot of my leadership and management style, right? So whatever topic you've thrown in front of me, my brain goes directly there without me even thinking about it. What the MBA got me was a little bit more about the business concept and the notion of how to evaluate, understand businesses, right? So it is about connecting the machines and the systems and the processes to this higher level objective, right? What is the market going? How do you spot trends? How do you spot innovation? How do you spot ways to convince and change the way people do things? So it gives you a whole breadth of knowledge on how companies work, right? In at least in theory. There's a lot of, you know, people that will think MBAs are not, let's say, a good path for entrepreneurs because it creates a lot of process, a lot of rigidity in your thinking. I'm more in the school of it depends. It depends on how you use it. I think for people that don't have the experience to go and learn the business in the hard way, this is as good as it gets for you to get a holistic view of how a business works. Do I think it needs to be 1.5 years, 2 years full-time dedication? Probably not. Not in today's world. I think there are other ways for you to gain that experience and gain that momentum. But it's very useful for you to think more holistically, especially if you want to target yourself in an executive career or something that's going to grow to a very big level. This is a very different gameplay than an early stage startup, right? So it's very interesting and very complementary. I forgot what was the last part of your question.
It was how this leadership style and approach to innovation within the tech industry.
Yeah, I mean, look, you have to have those components, right? Of what is the problem that you're trying to solve? How do you solve it? And of course, this has influenced me a lot in the way that I think and the way that I think about all the startups and innovation. I think the MBA gave me a little bit of, I would say, the theory behind how to do change management, which is so important when you're trying to innovate and when you're trying to change something and the way it works. If you think about how companies operate, and I'm talking more specifically about large companies, there's a lot of incentives in place that you need to understand. And that gives you a very big leverage for you to understand how to change it. MBAs, you know, because they are trained again to look holistically into what are these incentives, how companies actually work, what is the motivation behind this particular process or this particular metric. This is very helpful, of course, for you to understand, especially when you're building like a B2B enterprise type of software.
I love that. And then going to your experience now as a mentor. So you have experience as a mentor, as an advisor, as an angel investor. What are some of the common pitfalls you observed in startups and how do you advise founders to navigate those? Like, so you have the experience as a founder, but you also have the experience as a mentor. So what are the common themes that you've seen?
It will sound super cliche, right? But the truth is, if you look into the why startups fail most of the times, it's because the market is not there, right? You're super passionate about your idea, your product, and what you're building, and it turns out that the market doesn't exist or is not ready to do what you think is the best idea in the world, right? So getting it's super interesting because you know, many of the companies that were found in a certain time, they actually get to be successful many years later, right? Sometimes the founder was right. It was just skewed in time. And I feel like, you know, that this happens more often than not, that you are betting or you're investing in something, but the timing is not exactly there. Of course, the theory about startups is you go and talk to a lot of clients, you validate your idea, you find real signals out there before you start building. But the truth is, entrepreneurs, they take bets. They will eventually go for it. Maybe they will interpret the signal in a certain way and they will just start doing it, right? And that happens more often than not. Having that discipline around understanding the signals, going after true signals that give you that confidence that you should keep moving forward, is probably one of the things that I keep seeing time and time again, right? It's very tempting for you to just start trying to solve that problem with your great solution. And I feel like sometimes we skip you know, many steps that we should be more disciplined and more diligent to do it. The other extreme of that is also bad, right? If you are super afraid, if you are super cautious, if you want all the perfect signals for you to move forward, you're probably late. So again, it's all about that understanding of what you're trying to do, what are the risks that you're trying to do. I think there's a lot of understanding that there's a lot that can be done to understand where you are versus where the market is. But you have to be truthful to yourself, to the company that you're building, to the things that you're learning and reading the signs in a way that's as best as possible and biased, right? Because if you're too influenced in a way that you interpret the signals wrong, then it actually can speed up you falling off the cliff. You're just jumping faster, right? So that is probably the number one thing that I keep seeing time and time again.
I love something that you mentioned, because I think we said it in a couple of different episodes how, like, and I emphasize this, how, like, some founders, they're so passionate about their idea that they blind themselves a bit. It's like their child, so they don't want, no one wants to, like, for someone to tell you that your baby is ugly, right? but also, I think that's an important point that you brought, because I just by you saying this, I thought about so many stories from founders, which is your idea might be amazing. It might be the solution to the problem that you're solving, but the market might not be ready yet for it. And they were like, I remember founders talking about chatbots that they invented like way before, but the market wasn't ready for chatbots, right? Yeah. Or like different solutions that were within that helm that like, it was amazing. Everyone uses it now, but at the time it was so innovative that it was hard for the market to accept it. So I think those are two great sides of the coin that like really paying attention to the market signals.
Yeah, for sure. But look, if if playbooks were 100% correct and everybody could follow a recipe, everybody would be successful, and this would not be as fun as it is, right? So you have to have that balance. You have to have a little bit of craziness at the same time, and that is hard, right? Only people that have tried to be founders and have done it for real, they know how this feels, right? You know you should be doing more. Sometimes you know you should be thinking about this more diligent, but you just feel it's time for you to do it and you need to take that bath. And most frequently, again, you have something in between, right? Don't bet 100%. Don't be super cagey and cautious. That's not going to... Either one of the extremes is potentially catastrophic.
Yeah, it's definitely not an easy ride, right? It's very exciting, not to say the least. So I'm stepping into a little bit more personal now. So our previous guest always leaves a question for the next guest. So the question that we got for you today was, tell me about one of those gotcha moments where you repeated a mistake for so long without realizing, but someone shone light to it.
Wow.
That's deep.
That's very deep. I don't know if this is, I would say I repeated a long time, but I can tell you it took me a long time to figure that out, at least for myself. I had a CEO that I used to work with that he said to me, look, Jocelyn, the first 2 or 3 months of bad performance of someone that reports to you is their fault. The next 2 or 3 is your fault. Right? It took me a long time to figure what exactly this looked like. And again, now in hindsight, I know exactly what he was talking about. And I think there's a lot of wisdom packed into that. But it's that notion of, look, you gotta, of course, everybody that has been a manager, a leader of a team, faces the situation of this person. Yeah, I think there's something wrong with that performance. It's not at the level that I would hope for. And then you try some things, you spend more time, and then, maybe it's a little bit better. And then you fall off a cliff one day and say, no, to be honest, this is not as good as it should be, and I should do something about it, right? How long does it take for you to get to that cycle? For some people, it's super fast, right? It may be too fast even. They will just go and say, I don't care. This person doesn't meet my expectations. Let it go. But then you're potentially losing interesting people, interesting development opportunities, interesting people that could be amazing if you just gave them the right input, the right signals, the right reinforcements signals. If you take it too long, right, then it's about you haven't figured out that this thing was not working. And therefore, you're not going to achieve the results that you are promising the organization. You have a responsibility, right? Furthermore, if you take too long, the rest of the organization, of course, starts seeing this as well, right? And then it spreads like wildfire. So it is super hard for you to find, again, that balance around what is the speed, what is the let's say, right thing to do. I don't want to say, again, I've done this mistake 1,000 times, but at the beginning of my leadership career, I was more into, let me give this person another shot, let me give this person 10 different shots, and then you keep trying. There's a point where you shift that curve, right? That you are saying, no, wait a minute, here is what's fair with the person, and here's what's fair with the organization, here's what should be expected, and then you start being more diligent about this process of understanding what you should expect from people, what are the inputs that you can give, and how you expect and how the company should expect, let's say, the response to that. And of course, doing this in a cycle that makes sense, right? You don't want to be too fast. You certainly don't want to be too long.
I love that. And honestly, there's a point there that I agree with you. And I think that leaders don't learn to be clear enough about their expectations. And that's something like I've, even as a mentor, but when I was in positions of leadership, like my mind works in a different way. And I would always emphasize that. I was like, please tell me if something doesn't make sense. But sometimes even in mentorship meetings, when it's joint, I see the founder's face just going like blank. So like knowing like, you know, like body cues and being like, I was like, does that make sense? Do you want me to explain in another way? And just by asking that question, you invite the person's like, actually, I didn't hear, like, I didn't understand. So I have, for example, my developer teams that I learned that some of them were visual learners. So I was like, do you want me to draw this for you? And it sounds condescending, but it's not. They're like, please draw it so I can understand what you're saying. So like really learning how each person on your team understands it better and giving the openness, because it's easier. I always try to avoid frustration. So it's just like, let's clarify as much as we can so everyone is on the same page. And I appreciate what you're saying. So if you could tell me in one phrase, what is success to you?
It's to me, it's consistently creating positive impact, right? On people, on business, on my family. To me, you know, there's a combination of these things that is important to me personally. Of course, you have different milestones across in your life and different moments in life that you are prioritizing one or the other more. But in the end of the day, it's always about this notion of, you know, do I feel good about what I've done and the people that I've impacted, the business that I've impacted? If you can keep consistently doing that, I think you get to a great point. To me, that's success. In the past, I was very focused on potential milestones, and what I've learned, at least for myself, is that sure, I want to have the milestones, but I want to have consistency more than the milestones, right? So to me, that's kind of the way I think about success. Not a very precise answer. It works for me. It may not work for everybody.
Amazing. Thank you for sharing that, Gilson. Yeah. Also, a very fun fact, if you could choose a superpower, what would it be?
It's super funny. I don't know if you guys have seen this. Bill Gates, in one of his last podcasts, someone asked exactly that question for him, and he said, I wish I was smarter. And imagine Bill Gates, right? And he's like, that is your answer? He's like, yeah, no, I wish I could be smart. So, you know, if someone like him wants to be smarter, we probably should all strive for that in some way or form. But anyway. I don't know, maybe, you know, the closest thing that comes to my mind that I've thought about this is, wouldn't it be fun if you could manipulate or manage time, right? You could just go back in time and see some interesting things that happened in the past. You could fast forward and see how this world turns out to be in a couple of years, right? That I mean, many years from now, what would that look like? And what are the things that actually materialized? What are the things that didn't? I just feel like we are always in this battle of doing more with the time that we have. It would be amazing for us to be able to, you know, go back and forth and just do whatever observation you want to do. That would be an interesting superpower to have for sure.
I love that. So we're going to go quickly to rapid fire questions where we're going to give you two options and you can choose one. Okay.
All right.
Okay. So books or movies?
Lately movies. I don't know. Again, it changes from time to time for me, but I like to read. I like to learn from books, but I just, I'm in the phase where I like to see stories. I like to have a beginning, middle, end that I can contain very easily. That's kind of the phase that I'm in the last, I would say, couple of months at least.
Awesome. That's great. Phone call or text message?
Probably phone call for the people that are closest to me. I'd love to see that. But I'm an introvert, so text messages work great, and they are quick updates. I just sent this morning a text to a friend that I don't see for a while now, and it just feels like we've been, you know, in our day to day. So it works. I'd love to talk to people that I'm super close to. Of course.
So I think that as people live in Canada, the answer is pretty straightforward, but summer or winter?
Yeah, no, summer has a place, but you know, I'm trying to enjoy winter as well. I love, you know, I'm trying to be a better skier, trying to find interesting things to do in the winter, but sure, if I could choose, I would probably choose actually spring. To be honest,
okay. I would agree with you.
That would be spring. Amazing. Yeah.
So if you could give us one or two book recommendations for our listeners or for us to read, what would that be?
Yeah, I'm going to try to avoid the technical ones, which I actually like. I always think about good technical books that I refer to people for different types of topics, but one that is, you know, close to being technical, but I do feel like, and I mentioned this a couple of times during the podcast, I'm more interested than ever in the idea of time. And someone referred to me recently a book called Make Time, which is the same authors of the Sprint, right? Which are the people that actually developed that methodology. They are passionate about time management and techniques that help you make time for the things you actually want to do, right? So you can take this in any way you want, but their idea was, look, what if you could have back 2-3 hours of your day that you spend doing, I don't know, social media, watching Netflix, or doing things that don't necessarily are the things that you want to do, but you feel compelled to do it, right? And again, no criticisms on that. There are some people that relax just browsing and doing social media or Netflix. Totally fine. If it works for you, why not? But there are tons of techniques in that book that talk about this notion of, you know, if you can focus and use time more wisely, this could be an interesting, again, superpower, right? So I'm loving that technique, and it's a great book for busy people, which I think most of your listeners are. So it could be an interesting idea if you haven't heard of it. The second one that I think it's a second type of book that I've always liked is biographies. And the one that influenced me a lot, and I think can influence a lot of people that are your listeners, is Satya Nadella's Hit Refresh. It's not new. It's, I think, 4 or 5 years that he wrote it. But it's still, I still think it's very interesting, very inspiring. There's a lot of lessons there. There's a lot of ideas on culture change and how to shape a culture and how to think of a more compassionate leadership style, right? A more empathetic leadership style, which I think are interesting in themselves. Again, I really like biographies, and this is one that I think it's very interesting for people that are listening in.
Thank you for sharing those, Gilson. Before we close, as you were experienced the question, so we want to give you the opportunity of leaving a question to our next guest.
I think it's somewhat similar, but not necessarily. I always love to learn hacks that you have figured out that help you, right? Whether it's in your life, whether it's professionally, whether it's a new thing that you've discovered that is interesting and that's making an impact in your life, right? So maybe again, it's an entrepreneur thing, right? Maybe it's a person that is super curious. I don't know what it is, but I always ask this to people that I meet. So why not? Let's learn what is the next best hack that this next guest has learned, and maybe again we will learn something together with them.
Amazing. Thank you for that. Well, thank you so much for telling your story and for your time, Gilson. Anything you want to add before we close?
No, just want to thank you both for the opportunity, and of course it's always great. Hopefully this helps someone out there. And again, happy to connect with anybody that wants to connect. I'm in LinkedIn. I am, that's probably the media that works the best for me right now. But of course, if you want, reach out and I'll be happy to chat.
For sure. I definitely will take you up on that.
All right.
Well, this was episode number 72, Mastering Tech with Gilson Torrey. We'd like to thank all of our listeners and would like to remind you that we will be posting one episode bi-weekly, always with a different guest. So make sure to subscribe on your favorite streaming platform.